almost ready. We need five chairs. No, you're. And we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3067. And with that, we'll have a short explanation by our committee administrator. And then we have Senator Johnson on the phone. And if John, you guys can start coming up front here. John Orlando, Dave Honeycutt, Claudia Black, Jim
McCauley.
Oh, McCauley. McCauley, okay. And Mr. Tucker.
Randy.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3067 has no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact, and that's for both the original bill and the proposed Dash 2 amendment. The bill authorizes Multnomah and Washington counties to transfer Area 93 to Washington County on or before January 1st, 2014, if the governing body of each county approves the transfer plan by a majority vote. It requires the counties to notify the governor within 10 days of approving the transfer and directs the governor to issue a proclamation of the boundary change within 10 days of notice. And it revises the boundary coordinates of Multnomah County and Washington County for transfer of Area 93, effective 30 days after the governor issues a proclamation. The proposed Dash 2 amendment requires registration and election records of electors from a county from which the territory is removed to be transferred to the county in which the territory is added. And it provides that if the county boundary change occurs less than 90 days before an election or occurs after the deadline for filing notice of the county district or municipality election, the change is not effective for purposes of the election until after the day of the election.
So with that explanation, Senator Johnson, who is on the phone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. First, Mr. Chair, thank you for your courtesy in allowing me to testify by telephone. My job is a very happy one. Arrayed in front of you, I hope, is the same cast of characters that we had on the House side, and it is a tangible manifestation of a veritable love fest of agreement on this bill.
They're all smiling.
Pardon me?
They're all smiling.
They're singing Kumbaya in the background.
Yeah, if somebody could turn on the tape music of Kumbaya. Seriously, this bill has been a long time in negotiation. You will hear from others that will speak after me about the path that it has taken to arrive before you on its path, I hope, to the governor. Before I cede my time to Mr. Honeycutt, who goes over the technical details, I'd like to thank Representative Greenlick for his patience, his courtesy, and his genuine assistance in getting to this point. This is one of these issues that comes with redistricting. This had been Representative Greenlick's district for up until January of this year, and at that point became part of my Senate district. Representative Greenlick, who started this process in play, was extraordinarily generous in allowing us to move forward with his bill that eventually will bring to culmination a lengthy debate about the future of Area 93. And only just thanking and acknowledging the others that are arrayed in front of you for their help and assistance in getting here, I would like to give the rest of my time to Mr. Honeycutt, who will explain the technical issues. I think I did not identify myself for the record. I'm State Senator Betsy Johnson, District 16, that now proudly includes Area 93. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Honeycutt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Dave Honeycutt, Oregonians in Action, here in support of House Bill 3067. This process started, and it applies to an area called Area 93. It's also known as Bonnie Slope. It's approximately 160-acre piece of property that abuts Washington County. It's in Multnomah County, but it's right on the boundary with Washington County. The area was brought into the urban growth boundary by Metro in 2002. We're talking about land that's inside the urban growth boundary, not rural land. But it's had a difficult time developing. In fact, at this point, it has not developed predominantly or primarily because it's impossible for either Multnomah County or the City of Portland to provide the infrastructure and services necessary for the property to develop. There's an intervening piece of rural reserve property that's in between this property and the City of Portland. So it's difficult for that property to be served by either Portland or Multnomah County. And the portion of Washington County to which the property abuts is developed and served with services. So there's water and sewer. Stub essentially to the county line and right next to these properties. It makes all the sense in the world. I don't think Metro anticipated this problem at the time that the land was brought in 2002, and it makes all the sense in the world for this property to be served by Washington County. In order to do that, Washington County would appreciate having this property become part of Washington County. We've had a couple of meetings up in the area with the property owners affected up there. We took a vote at the first meeting last October of the property owners in Area 93, asked how many of them wanted to come into Washington County, move out of Multnomah and come into Washington County, and the vote was something like 57-3. Moving the property into Washington County is really the only way that we can ensure that the land develops, which is what is called for under our state planning goals since it's been brought into the urban growth boundary. So it makes all the sense in the world to do this. Washington County and Multnomah County have brought this bill as the way to make this happen, and we fully support their efforts and what they're trying to do. So we love this bill and hope that the committee will give it a favorable review and send it on its way.
So with that, whoever's next.
Go ahead, John. Okay. My name is John Orlando. I am a property owner in the Bonnie Slope area. I suppose I'm supposed to say thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee. Senator Johnson, good to hear your voice. Anyway, I've owned property in the area from 1998, and Dave Honeycutt pretty much summed up what I would say in my letter that I'd written in that, but I'm just here on behalf of the other property owners in the area. There's a petition or signed petitions that I didn't give each of you a copy, but I wanted to get that in the record that demonstrates the overwhelming support of moving the county line or moving into Washington County that me and the rest of our neighbors are in support of. There's been two meetings. The first one organized by Representative Greenlick and Andy Dyke, and that's the one that Dave referred to with, I mean, literally two or three people dissenting that, or they didn't really dissent, they weren't sure if they wanted to move. We've had another one with Andy, that Andy Dyke wanted to get together and talk about, that Senator Johnson was there, and Washington County wanted to explain some of the issues or reasons why they wanted to do it their way. And again, there was overwhelming support from the neighbors once, you know, we heard the explanation from Washington County and, you know, why they wanted to do the things that they thought they needed to do. And we still support it and want this to happen.
Thank you very much.
Chair Roland, members of the committee, for the record, Jim McCauley, representing Washington County. I don't want to go into too much detail, but essentially the bill provides a template for a boundary adjustment to occur between Washington and Multnomah County. We've been working on this for, I've lost count of the months, but it's somewhere in the neighborhood of 7 to 9 months.
1 year.
Okay, 1 year. We'll go with 1 year. And it has become an ongoing communication between our two counties and staff to work through a lot of the details which ensues. And there's a reason why there isn't a whole lot of detail in this, is you wouldn't want it there in the first place. There's an awful lot that has to take place with the boundary adjustment, and we're getting all of that worked out through, again, a kind of an ongoing meeting process, and then ultimately in the transfer agreement that we'll have in place before the end of this year. So from Washington County's perspective, this provides a good template on how to make this boundary adjustment work. We have another a few years of planning to take that are going to have to ensue before we physically see a shovel in the ground for this area to develop. And, you know, again, we're just happy with the way this has worked out. I will want to speak just to the Dash 2 amendments really quick. Those are a result of ongoing conversation with our elections staff, both in Washington and Multnomah County, as well as the Secretary of State's office, and are essentially just updates in election law to make sure that we don't mess up in this legislation and prevent somebody from being able to participate in an election or run for an election, in essence. So thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Claudia Black representing Multnomah County. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My testimony will be very short and sweet. I'm here in support of House Bill 3067 with the Dash 2 amendments. As you've heard over the past, actually I think it's more like 14 months, Jim, Multnomah County, Washington County, and Metro have worked very collaboratively to try to identify a solution for this longstanding concern. And House Bill 3067 is the product of that collaboration. We believe that this will ultimately result in the provision of the necessary services for the residents of Area 93. And we really appreciate the leadership of Senator Johnson, Representative Greenlick, the Washington County Commission, and Metro Council in their leadership. So we urge the passage, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. And Randy.
Thank you, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. Randy Tucker, I'm Legislative Affairs Manager for Metro. We were very involved last year in helping to develop the solution that's before you today, though in the last few months most of the details have been worked out just between the two counties, since they are the participants in the agreement that this legislation would authorize. I just want to say for the record that the Metro Council strongly supports the legislation. It's one of the priority pieces of legislation we'd like to see pass this session. I also would like to note that I did attend the first of the two community meetings that Mr. Orlando and Mr. Honeycutt mentioned. And I've said this before in other forums, but I was very impressed, given the long road that these landowners have had to travel to get to this point and the frustrations that they've experienced over the last decade since the Metro Council brought this land into the urban growth boundary. I was very impressed with the positive, solution-oriented spirit that they brought to that meeting. There was no anger that I could discern. There was no finger pointing. They just really wanted to figure out a good solution. So hopefully we've arrived at a good solution that will really help resolve this longstanding problem. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions for this panel?
Nope.
Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We have one more person who signed up, Les Poole. If there's anyone else that would like to come speak, they can come up now. And thanks for being here. And be sure to identify yourself first, and we'd love to hear.
Les Poole. I live in Gladstone and own property out not far from this location in Clackamas County. So my testimony will be very brief. First of all, I support this action. I support the bill. It's pleasant to see two counties and Metro all on the same page with it. That should send a very, very strong message. And I look at this somewhat like, it's certainly not an annexation, but if you use that as a template, this in a way is like an annexation. They've had a good process. The neighbors are all involved. They've overwhelmingly approved of the action. So if you were to look at this as rather than, you know, between two counties, I think you'd look at it somewhat like an annexation, where you've got willing participants across the board. I also think this falls right in line with Goal 14, which is urbanization, provision of developable land. And Goal 14 calls for a smooth and orderly transition, which I think this will help do. I would also say that Mr. Honeycutt is well known for doing good work with and very meticulous work with land use matters. So I feel that the legal representation has been real good. So I'd make a strong recommendation that we move this forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for this?
Nope.
Seeing none, thanks again. So we're going to close our public hearing on House Bill 3067. And we'll open a work session on 3067.
Mr. Senator Roblin, I move for the adoption of the Dash 2 amendments dated 3/2013 into House Bill 3067.
Senator Przanski moves to adopt the Dash 2 amendments dated 3/2013. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection? Seeing none, they are adopted. Senator Przanski.
Mr. Chair, I now move the bill as it adopted by, or amended, excuse me, by the Dash 2 amendments to the floor with the due pass recommendation. That's House Bill 3067.
Senator Przanski moves House Bill 3067 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, is there? Yes.
All I got to say is when I see Area 93, it reminds me of one of these movies.
I know.
I'm thinking New Mexico or something like that. But
yeah, it's an area where things go away, right? Yeah.
And then they reappear.
And reappear. So we're excited. Pardon?
You should go visit it sometime.
Yeah, we'll have to come visit. That's true. Any other discussion? Seeing none, is there any objections? Seeing none, it is adopted and moved to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Johnson,
would you like to carry this, Senator Johnson?
I would be delighted, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the courtesy.
Absolutely.
And Mr. Chair,
yes.
I will volunteer to be a backup since
okay.
These are my two counties if Senator Johnson is not able to carry it.
Okay, very good.
Is that good for you, Senator Johnson?
So now you have a reason to get back here, and if not, you've got this person on your heels, kind of.
Cool.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. You going to stay along and listen to all the wonderful testimony, find out about microbes and other things?
I am going to politely decline and continue my inexorable march back to work.
Thank you. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Another one over the big one. There you go.
Did we close it already? Oh, yeah. And for the record, Senator Close and Senator Bertschinger are excused for this one. So with that, we'll close our work session on House Bill 3067. And we're going to open a work session only is what we need, really.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right? A work session on House Bill 2345A. We'll have a short explanation on what we've done and where we are today with this bill.
Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 2345A has no revenue impact, and a fiscal statement has been issued on both the original bill and the Dash A4 amendment. This, if you recall, is we had the hearing on May 9th, and this is a bill that creates the Oregon Innovation Infrastructure Task Force to make recommendations to the Legislative Assembly. And the original bill that came to us required the task force to report to the Legislative Assembly no later than October 1st, 2013. The proposed Dash A4 amendment changes the task force report date to no later than December 31st, 2013.
And this is the bill, for people who weren't here, that we had a lot of conversation about how do we move forward with infrastructure development over the next number of years and how do we get the capital, and sometimes we can use public and private capital to do this. And I think it has some really interesting opportunities for us in the future. And does this have a subsequent referral to?
It has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Okay. So with that, I will entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move for the adoption of the A4 amendment dated 5/10/13 into House Bill 2345.
Senator Przanski moves to adopt the Dash A4 amendments dated 5/10/13. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, they are adopted. Senator Przanski.
Mr. Chair, I move the bill as amended by the Dash 4A amendments, House Bill 2345. To the floor with the due pass recommendation, and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Senator Przanski moves the engrossed version of House Bill 2345 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? So ordered. We don't have to have a measure for that, so we're going to close the work session on House Bill. Oh, and Senator Barrett Sugar is excused, and we will close the work session on House Bill 2345A, and we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2746A. And with that, we'll have Representative Unger come up forward as Raquel.
Is it okay if I bring Dave?
Sure. You can bring your people up with you. And then Raquel can give a short explanation of our bill.
Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 2746A has a minimal revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact. This bill modifies the requirements to alter, restore, or replace a dwelling on exclusive farm use land. An important component to keep in mind is that the Act will sunset and restore the existing statute effective on January 2nd, 2024. So the current statute says that to qualify for a replacement dwelling under law, the existing structure must have the following features: intact exterior walls and roof, indoor plumbing, including a kitchen, sink, toilet, and bathing facilities, interior wiring for lights, a heating system, and the dwelling must be removed, demolished, or converted within 3 months of completion of the replacement dwelling. In addition, the current law allows a person to request a deferred replacement permit to allow for construction of the replacement dwelling at any time, provided that the existing structure is removed, demolished within 3 months after the permit is issued. Otherwise, that permit is void. So what this bill is trying to do is address some of the components of existing law, and that it expands the dwellings eligible for replacement to include those that formerly had those specified features. And then it also retains, and if the dwelling to be replaced formerly had those specified features, or if it was removed improperly from a tactual or previous replacement dwelling permit was voided, it requires the replacement dwelling to be sited on the same tract using all or part of the replaced dwelling footprint, or to be near certain specified boundaries, and when possible to be located within a cluster of structures or within 500 yards of another structure. And then it also provides that the replacement permit does not expire but becomes void if the dwelling is not removed within the time specified. It also allows property owners whose permits were voided before the Act's effective date to be valid if the permit holder removes or converts the dwelling and records that action within 1 year of the effective date. And the bill would allow dwellings that no longer have these characteristics, essentially, but did it one time, to qualify. So that's there's more provisions in there. It's a pretty lengthy bill, so I'm sure they'll probably have additional explanation for you.
With that, Representative.
Nothing like that warm-up. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Representative Ben Unger, and I represent House District 29, which is Western Washington County. And I am proud to present House Bill 2746 to you. As you could hear from that long introduction, this bill is not without its complications, but let me try to break down some of it more simply about how we approached it, and then I'll have Dave. This is a bill that we worked on quite a bit on the House side, so and Dave, as well as Thousand Friends and a bunch of other people, were partners in trying to come up with this bill, which we were oh so close to getting perfect. We have a small fix. the main issue we're trying to address here is the ability for farmers to replace dwellings on farmland. That's the simple way to describe it. It is a complicated process to do right now. There are some farmers who have, and some farmers who will testify later today to their specific situations, who have had trouble taking a house that was clearly a house where people used to live and getting the permits they need to replace that dwelling. And so this bill brought before you here is to address this group of people who have a house that has all the characteristics of a house, but they don't quite meet the current guidelines for getting a new permit, tweaking them a little bit so that we can replace those dwellings where appropriate while respecting the land use laws that I think are important to respect out in these agricultural areas, and then sunset this bill so that we all just go back to the way it was. So hopefully everyone will get the hint that they have 10 years to fix this problem. Otherwise, they'll be out of luck again, and I'm not going to rewrite this bill. But the long and short of it is, the goal of this bill is to make it a little bit easier for farmers who need to replace their dwellings to replace them so that farmers can live on their land. And just a brief moment about why that's important. You know, these days, it's just as important now as it was 100 years ago for farmers to live close to the things that they're farming. Oftentimes now, the value of the crop is such that they want to be close to their farm, or oftentimes we have to be farming 24 hours a day. And so if you have a blueberry field that is currently in production, it's kind of important to be there to be able to do all the different pieces of monitoring that need to go into monitoring pests and birds and water and all the different parts. And so when you can't live on the field, it just makes the whole thing a little bit more difficult. This allows more people to live on their farms, and it doesn't compromise the integrity of the land use laws that we so desperately need to make sure we have enough farmland available for everyone. I have Dave up here to help me with the technical pieces because he's the expert that got this bill to consensus in the House. And so he's going to explain a little bit about how he helped out and also about the small, very, very small final fix, the Dash 13s, I think, unfortunately, to give you some sense of how many other fixes we had.
Oh, thank yeah, you, the old Dash 13.
That's right.
Chair Relevant, members of the committee, Dave Honeycutt, Oregonians in Action, here on House Bill 2746. The reason this bill is so long is because it amends two sections of ORS Chapter 215, 215, 213, and 215, 283. Those are the two sections of the statutes that prescribe uses allowed in exclusive farm use zones. 215, 213 applies to Lane and Washington counties. 215, 283 applies to the other 34 counties. But each one of those provisions of the Oregon revised statutes are probably, if not the longest, amongst the longest provisions in the ORS. So anytime you try and amend those, you end up with a 34 or 35-page bill. And that's what you've got in front of you, and that's why it's so long. As Representative Unger said, and I appreciate his willingness to work with us over on the House side, the goal of this is to clean up the replacement dwelling statutes and allow farmers in a few circumstances to build houses, to replace dwellings that are already on the property but have become essentially, for lack of a better term, dilapidated. It's an important bill. Replacement dwellings happen with fair frequency in any EFU zone. You own a house and you want to, it burns down. You want to make it bigger. You want to make it smaller. You want to move from one part of the property to the other part of the property, whatever. The replacement dwelling is a fairly frequent application in the EFU zone, and the replacement dwelling statutes have been around, as far as I know, ever since these two provisions of the law were put into the statutes. And so we like this bill. We like the changes that were made. It's because it's a fairly technical area of the law. We had to be pretty careful in how we drafted the amendments. And unfortunately, this morning I came to Representative Unger and said, we've got a problem. And the problem is in Section 2. It's Section 2, Sub 2B. It's on page 1 of the bill, lines 19 to 20. One of the changes that have been made to the replacement dwelling statutes with this bill is that the dwelling, in order to replace it, the dwelling has to have been assessed for property tax purposes for at least the last 5 years. The problem becomes, what happens if the dwelling was built 4 years ago and it burns down, or 3 years ago, or 2 years ago, or whatever? It burns down, it's destroyed by flood, something of that nature. The way the bill's currently written, if that were the fact pattern, the property owner who just basically has a new or relatively new dwelling would not be able to replace it. Currently, they would be able to replace it, but if this bill passed with this language, they wouldn't be able to replace that. So we needed to add language to to deal with the situation where a dwelling was less than 5 years old, and if that was to make sure that property owners of those types of dwellings, if the dwelling needed to be replaced, that they could benefit and use the provisions of this statute as they could under current law.
They could wait for 10 years and then they
That's
could
right.
do it.
I was suspecting.
Well, yeah, tis true, Mr. Chair. Yes, they could wait for 10. Well. Yeah, probably. Yes. Dash 13s or whatever, we've got, Representative Unger gave me the note, we have it down at Ledge Council, and we're getting those amendments prepared, and so we hope that the committee will entertain those amendments and move this bill forward with a due pass recommendation.
So, any questions? Yes, Senator Pruszynski.
So, Dave, your testimony is that if, under current law, one of those dwellings currently under 5 years of age could in fact be replaced. This is just a typo within the bill as it's currently written.
Chair Roblin, Senator Pruszynski, that's correct. Under the current law, the dwelling would be replaced. If this bill passed with this language, we'd be back in 2 years or 4 years or whenever the first person that had this problem had it, and I'd be up here in front of you with a couple of with a husband and wife that were crying. And we'd be asking you to fix it then. So we're just trying to take care of it now.
But under current law, they could have done it.
Yes, under current law, they can replace it, absolutely.
Other questions for this panel? Seeing none, thank you both.
Thank you.
So we have a group of people. Next, Dave Vanesh. Is it Vanesh?
It's okay, I understand.
I'm sorry, thanks, David. David Tongs and Mark Unger. And I guess there's room for Katie. There's four chairs up there. Come on up, Katie. We made a big group so we can have lots of people come visit.
Do we want to let Katie go first?
No, she signed up last. So
I'll have to say last if they go first.
My name is Dave Vanesh, and I reside at 36130 Northwest Wren Road, Cornelius, Oregon. Chair Senator Roblin and committee members, thank you for allowing me to testify today. I and my wife farm approximately 2,300 acres. We own 760 acres. We grow grass seed, clover seed, hazelnuts, and wheat. And we've been farming since 1977. The family's is a century farm, 1896. I and my wife bought a 87-acre parcel in 1996.
Thank you.
We'd been farming it for about 15 years, and it had an old house on it. The house was built in 1874, whole set of farm buildings, you know. And so we applied for a replacement dwelling permit on the house because it had been inhabited, and the county gave us a permit, which was good for 2 years. And the reason we applied for the permit was when we bought the place, we bought it for the appraised value, and the building site was appraised for $30,000. So we didn't want to lose our building site value. But we didn't want to build a new house. So I began working through the legislature with Farm Bureau and Thousand Friends, and we eventually crafted Senate Bill 861 or 863. And by that time, which was 2007, my house no longer was able to be approved for a replacement dwelling because it no longer had sound walls, roof, and plumbing. The meth people had been in it, all the plumbing, the wiring, everything was gone. And so that's why we're here today with this bill. And this bill would allow us to remove our eyesore and our liability because it's difficult to keep people out of this building. We have it all boarded up and no trespassing signs everywhere, but they still keep breaking into it. So this building would, or this bill would allow us to ask for a permit from the county, and we would be granted a replacement dwelling deferred permit that would go into our deed, and my wife and I or our children would be allowed to use that permit at some point in the future if we desired to build a dwelling there.
Thank you.
Chairman.
Do you want to pull a microphone over just so it's facing you? That's close.
Chairman, Senators, my name is David Tongis. Our farm is located at 9095 Northwest Kirkman Road in Cornelius, Oregon. Our store is about the same as Dave's. I'm part owner of our family farm. We raise grass seed, grain, and clover seed on approximately 600 acres that we own. In the last few years, or 10 years, we've bought other farms, and they had these vacant or these houses on them, and the houses aren't good enough to rent. So more or less, the house just sits vacant and deteriorates. And so I took a few pictures there. I think you have the pictures of some of the houses, or these houses that we own, and so you can kind of get an idea of what we're talking about there. So I guess we just would like the ability to be able to tear the houses down and have the option to rebuild in the future. So, thanks.
Thank you.
My name is Mark Unger. I live just down the road from Steve's, from Steve Unger, Ben's dad. They live on the Century Farm, and we live next to it. And anyway, we've farmed since 1978. Oh, thank you for letting me share today in front of the committee. We have a piece of property that we also purchased that has a house on it that is dilapidated, and we plan on putting in blueberries there, and it would be very advantageous to have a dwelling there and be able to have one of our sons that farm with us live there and be able to keep track of things that are going on there. Right now, we have a fair amount of vandalism that happens. We have it posted also, and but we've, like last year, the cop stopped and there was somebody tearing a car apart there and pulling parts out, and so it would be great to have a residency there and watching over the young blueberry planting, which is not in the ground yet, but plans are to do that. And after several years of having blueberries in the ground, we would be able to go with a different way of getting a house there with the $80,000 clause. But in those years until that happens, we'd be driving back and forth, checking on the field a lot more than we would if we had one of the sons or daughter live there. So
thank you very much. Okay. Katie, it's your turn.
Good afternoon. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. Katie Fast with the Oregon Farm Bureau. Oregon Farm Bureau supports these changes to the replacement dwelling law. The important pieces of the legislation is, one, giving some additional flexibility for landowners where the houses have had either pieces of the home become deteriorated, or vandals have come in, as you've heard, and stolen the wiring or the plumbing. So that has been removed. So the qualifications currently under a replacement dwelling is that it has a roof, walls, plumbing, and wiring, which are important qualifications to show that this is actually a home that we're replacing and not some other type of building. But there are cases where those, for multiple different reasons, those materials are no longer in the home. And you've heard some examples here today. It also makes the permits a more simplified process. Right now under the law, there's kind of two tiers. You're going to do a quick replacement right away or a long-term replacement. This creates just one option. So you can replace the home right away under the application, or have a deferred replacement for some time, which I think gives an incentive for farmers to make some improvements to the properties and get some of these buildings kind of cleared out and give them time when they're financially able to replace them. And the ability to replace a home is important as we see a aging generation of farmers that are wanting to bring the next generation back to the farm or are looking to replace these homes for employees as a employment benefit. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
The other thing this bill does, as I understand it, is that your house could be located right in the middle of your acreage, and you'd rather have it over by the road as opposed to that. And this would allow you to move that. Is that correct?
So, Chair Roblin, currently that is the case. So, okay. But for The other piece that this bill does, so it still allows for people that would qualify under the statute now that they can move the home to anywhere on the property. The other piece that this legislation does, and this was a agreed-upon amendment in the House, is that it allows for these areas where we're opening up the flexibility on replacing the home, so the wiring's been removed or the plumbing's been stolen out of it, that they can move to another piece on, they can put it in the same place, but there's some criteria on where they can move it. So it's closer to boundaries, natural boundaries on the property. The other piece I did not talk about is it does, which Mr. Honeycutt kind of touched on, it does add a new tax requirement that property taxes have been paid on the property for the past 5 years. And I should add for the record, Farm Bureau is very supportive of the amendment that Mr. Honeycutt referenced and getting that to be the true intent of what the legislation was set up in the House.
Good. Any questions for this panel? Senator Perzanski.
Just a clarification. If the house is removed, I thought I heard the goal may be to sometime in the future to be able to rebuild at some point in time. Is there some duration of how long that period is before they would be obligated to do that?
So, Chair Roblin, Senator Perzanski, in the proposed legislation, it would be it would be a transferable right only to other family members. So I would say it's for the life of the landowner unless they were to sell that property to another landowner or another family member, then it could be transferred onto them. But it couldn't be, they couldn't go for a replacement dwelling application, tear the property down, have that put on the deed, and then market it to a non-family member.
So
they would have to be the one to build the new home, but there's no limit on that time frame. Currently in statute, you can apply for a deferred replacement dwelling that would have no limit. The one change in this legislation is that it would be, could be transferable to a family member.
Any more questions?
I have some, I think, but I don't want to ask them right now because I'm not sure if I'm going to ask them right. So I think offline I'll talk to Katie or today.
Sure. That sounds great. Because we have an amendment we're waiting for, so we can't really move the bill right now.
Exactly.
But, yeah. Yes, Senator Close.
Can I just clarify? So, Katie, you're saying when the old deed expires and they do the new deed, it wouldn't be on there. Is that correct? If it's sold?
Correct. I think to address your question, Senator Close, so if Mr. Van Ash were to put in a apply for a placement dwelling application, he has that as part of his deed, and I need to clarify if it goes on the deed or not, but he has that right to rebuild that permit. Mm-hmm. If he were to sell that property to a non-family member, that would not be allowable, transferable. If he were to sell it to his son could rebuild there.
Well, yes.
And I would assume if my son or daughter inherited it, they could also apply and be granted the dwelling.
Yeah. Right. Well, so I understand in the sense of the family connection and all that. So if let's just say if someone had that ability to rebuild, they could, in fact, though, build the new structure and then actually market that on the open market.
Chair Roblin, Senator Perzanski, that is true, and that is true under the current statute as well.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions for this panel? Seeing none, thank you all for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we will await those. Do we want to post, move this to next week, or do we have time
to post?
We have time to post it. Okay.
So until Monday.
We will close the public hearing on House Bill 2746A, and we will open a public hearing. No, is Senator Representative Johnson's his comment?
Yeah. If he's I can do it if he's not here.
Okay, we're going to...
Yeah, start out with Kazinsky.
Okay, okay. We're going to open... He said he was on his way, his aide. We're going to open a public hearing on HCR 12. And when Representative Johnson gets here, he can come right up front. Les Poole wanted to speak, but on this one or not?
On the other one, I apologize.
Okay. Mark, oh, sir. Come on up, Mark. And Senator Przanski as well, if he wants to say something.
I'll stay here. I'll just wait.
So we just opened a public hearing on HCR 12. And Representative Johnson.
I keep getting promoted. That's nice.
Yes, I know.
I talked to my other senator friend. Chair Roblin, members of the committee, thank you very much for having this hearing on HCR 12.
You know how to pronounce this yeast?
Not yet.
Okay.
I'm Mark Johnson, State Representative from House District 52. Designating Saccharomyces cerevisiae, or brewer's yeast, as the official microbe of the state of Oregon is an important recognition of the impact this little microbe, little but mighty microbe, has had on our state's economy and culture. Saccharomyces cerevisiae is a yeast used for brewing beer, making wine, cheese, and baking. It is most commonly known as brewer's yeast or ale yeast due to its being instrumental in the brewing of beer. Oregon's regarded nationwide as ground zero for the thriving craft brewing industry in the United States, with Portland having the largest craft brewing market in the U.S. and nearly 170 brewing facilities and over 300 wineries statewide. Oregon-made beer and wine is ingrained in the lives of Oregonians and is literally famous from sea to shining sea. Craft brewing alone has an economic impact on Oregon of at least $2.4 billion per year, and Oregon's craft brewing industry and wineries employ thousands of Oregonians and are award-winning and world-renowned. The rise of these industries in Oregon is owed first and foremost to Saccharomyces cerevisiae. For instance, my district is home to Y-East Laboratories, who have been cultivating yeast just outside of Hood River for over 25 years now. Their work with yeast has allowed craft and home brewers to buy locally and contribute significantly to Oregon's reputation as a place of innovation and entrepreneurship. Since passing the House 58-0, the proposal has generated quite a bit of statewide, national, and even international interest in the idea. This media focus, of course, helps to promote Oregon's craft brew industry and provides a much-needed boost to our economy. I might mention that since we set off down this trail and the bill has garnered a bit of attention, the story has been picked up by the Associated Press nationally and locally, the Oregonian, Statesman Journal, the Mail Tribune, the Columbian, OPB, NPR. I've even had an interview with the Canadian Broadcasting Company and Food Network Magazine, I believe, also has been focusing on this. So a lot of attention over a small but mighty little microbe that I think really symbolizes so much about what's good about Oregon. We like to raise our things here, grow our things here, produce our products that make us who we are, and I think Saccharomyces cerevisiae is certainly at the core of that. So with that, I'd like to pass off to Ian Croxall, who is from Santiam Brewery right here in Salem, Oregon. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ian Croxall. I am a U.S. citizen. I'm a proud Oregonian. I live here in Salem, and I am a part owner of Santiam Brewing Company, and it's a small craft brewery tasting room here in Salem. I recently met a few representatives in the tasting room of a craft brewery who talked about this resolution to recognize brewer's ale yeast as a state microbe. You know, there were a few chuckles. We had some good conversation about it, and some of my colleagues pondered, well, what's the reason behind this? And it got me thinking. I am an immigrant. I'm an Oregonian by choice. And the concept of state emblems of symbols was new to me. But as a new transplant, I became familiar with this, you know, the state beaver, Oregon grape, Dungeness crab, Chinook salmon, Douglas fir, and the other emblems that represent the national treasures of our wonderful state. But why brewer's yeast? Well, I think the state emblems don't just represent the state's flora and fauna, they represent our cultural heritage, and Oregon has a long history connected to the brewing industry. Hops have been grown commercially in Oregon for over 140 years, and hop growing was one of the few brewing-related industries to survive the cultural and economic devastation of Prohibition. Did that by exporting hops to Europe. And the legacy of that cultural devastation was very much still in evidence when I arrived here in the 1980s. I grew up in a country also with a long historical connection to brewing, and I have fond childhood memories of going on Sunday drives with my parents to quaint English pubs for Sunday lunch. Going to the pub was very much a family affair. It was a place that one would stop off on the way from work, home from work, meet with friends and colleagues, and get to know your neighbors. But when I arrived here, it was very different. There were no quaint little pubs, just dark, seedy, windowless taverns, tawdry dens of iniquity. And I was shocked, and I resorted to staying at home and brewing my own beer because there was no good beer to be had anywhere. But that was 25 years ago, and since then, everything has changed. The state has nurtured more than its fair share of innovative home brewers who, with the help of Saccharomyces cerevisiae and a supportive state government, have started and sustained a boom in craft brewing, the artisan creation of a product that brings joy, happiness, and culture to our state. Brew pubs are now cultural icons, the community centers, places for families and even business meetings and conferences. There are nearly 140 breweries in Oregon, and most are small microbreweries like mine. This cultural and economic boom was brought about by the work of artisan brewers, supportive government, and the one thing that makes it all possible, Saccharomyces cerevisiae. And this great little microbe is probably responsible for the civilization of mankind, as there now appears to be evidence of brewing that predates the evidence of baking by some 3,000 years. But while that might be debatable, what isn't is that it's certainly responsible for an emerging Oregon culture, an Oregonian industry that produces some of the best beers in the world, and boasts an economic impact of $2.5 billion a year. Saccharomyces cerevisiae is the perfect emissary, a representative emblem of a state industry and a cultural heritage to be proud of. Please adopt this resolution.
Any questions for this group?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to, I guess, have some questions, but I think also we need to give some kudos here. Ian's brewery, I did not know he was part owner. I met Matt when he was working with Venti's, which is a local restaurant here, and he told me back then he was kind of like their beer guru and event person that they were going to be striking out and starting up the Sanium Brewing. I've had the opportunity to find myself in the tasting room on more than one occasion this session, and might actually be over there today. I'll give a plug. If I'm not mistaken, they'll have the mobile pizza cart there tonight.
That's correct.
And actually $4 pints, if I'm not mistaken, at
that
least for...
On some, the cask ales.
On the, not on the cask.
Just on the cask.
Oh, just on the cask. Yeah. Oh, that's even better.
Yeah.
See, you learn something all the time. But it's one of those things that is very interesting. I did look at the background on here, and I'm not sure who documented when. It says in 1985, following the legalization of brew pubs, the craft brewing industry grew. I think we need to correct that because 1984 is when we first had the first breweries opening up, which was Widmer and Bridgeport. I did do a little Google search because that's what I had remembered, because we too are immigrants. We came only from Texas, that other country down on the other end, to be Oregonians by choice. But in 1984 is when we made the move, and we were happy to first be exposed to home brewing that my father then told me about how it used to be done in the earlier days. And I started doing home brewing in 87 based on that opportunity, but then having the opportunity to start getting craft beers to the point where many of my friends who used to brew say, why should I be brewing when I can go to the neighborhood craft brewing? So it's, I think, a great honor, and I want to also give kudos to Represent Johnson for his adventure and allowing me to be part of it, of being the Oregon Craft Brewers Caucus that we have here for our Oregon legislators. And it definitely has made a difference. I can tell you that over the years as we've been talking, people will be listening, but really I don't know if they actually heard. But this time there's been at least three meetings of the Craft Brewers Caucus. I was not able to attend the last one at Widmer up in Portland, but the one we were together at prior to that was at Seven Brides, which is in Silverton, and it was well attended by members as well as the craft brewing industry. And clearly I think we have an opportunity to help foster, as Ian said, even more than we have as state government, to actually have the industry lead out and be a destination point for people coming to the Northwest. And I think this is a great way to honor they say what makes it all happen, and that's the yeast. Hops is very important. I love it, but you don't actually have to have it to have the beer.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure why Gilgamesh does what they do, but they do what they do, and more power to them, each their own. But it's also, I think, important to know that that yeast is also very good for you nutritiously, vitamin B. So this is a great way to...
So where is this place located?
It's on 19th at Gilcrest, and if you would like to have a tour, I think we could probably work that out.
We actually have a, as a result of this, talking about it, we actually brewed a commemorative beer. And it's a bipartisan amber, and it's going to be ready in about 2 or 3 weeks.
That's wonderful. We'll need it about that time to close the deals here in the building.
And I might mention, in a conversation with the governor last week, I suggested it might be really nice to have the signing ceremony at Mahonia, and perhaps we could do that on the 28th, and we've been invited up there by the governor and the first lady to have a little interaction. So we'll see.
Senator Burdick, first of all.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, first of all, I wouldn't even dream of opposing this bill because I'm very aware that by 2/3 vote of the Senate, a person can be expelled.
That's right.
So I'm not criticizing this bill, but I do come from a communications background.
Mm-hmm.
And brewer's yeast sounds really mundane. And Saccharomyces cerevisiae.
Mm-hmm.
Is a real mouthful. So I was wondering if Saccharomyces cerevisiae has a nickname.
We just call it yeast.
Which gets back to the mundane part, because this really is a very classy name, but I do worry about people's ability.
Unfortunately,
to...
it's Latin for beer fungus, so we're probably better off with that.
Well, beer fungus, now that has a little panache to it.
We've been into mushrooms lately. So
that's right, fungi.
Fungi.
I knew it would get back to fungi
that's
one
right,
way or
exactly.
another in this committee.
Senator Close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick comment as well. My mother was prescribed brewer's yeast in the 20s for a condition she had by a doctor. And she's passed that on to me, and I take it as well regularly, but she is now 101 years old. So.
Wow.
Maybe we can attribute that to brewer's yeast.
I think Senator Prusansky is going to live forever.
I'm going to say breakfast for champions.
When I first saw the bill, I was a bit concerned, and because we've talked about the history of it. It really isn't originally from Oregon, like the immigrants who mentioned that they have immigrated here. And then I remembered in our conversations, we have a soil called Jory mm-hmm. soil. It didn't start here. It came in a big flood and some other stuff and got washed here. So we have a number of new residents to our state that have become a big part of our state. So
absolutely.
I guess the same thing could be true with the yeast. Yes.
And Mr. Chair, I think the other thing is that really noting about yeast and its importance here, Representative Johnson gave kudos to Y Yeast, which is the company. That company, the history I know, and I know Representative Johnson knows it better than I do, is one that was very small in size when mm-hmm. it started. And it actually, I think, was doing very selected yeast for specific breweries. And now it is, I'm not sure what their value, their worth is. But I know for myself as a home brewer, many people who relied on the old dry packets have just basically, it's like, well, not anymore. Because it gives you a much cleaner, crisper product by using the liquid yeast.
It's a dynamic science, and it just tends to become more and more enriched with each little evolution within the industry. So, with people like Ian and what they're doing and so forth, it really is exciting to see. There's just a culture of how can we push the envelope a little bit. Culture.
Yeah, no pun intended.
No pun intended. But I think the state, innovators like Ian and so forth, just inspire one another to better and better levels of production and refinement of the product. So we're the beneficiaries, those of us who are privileged to live here. And I think the rest of the country looks at us as a pretty cool state that has the opportunity to have an industry like this that it's so vibrant and so fun to be a part of.
It was also interesting to me when I went on a tour with schools to Germany. I was introduced, every town I went to had their own distinctive beer, and
mm-hmm.
It was amazing. Because of the craft brewery, and I'm sure that was probably true in England as well,
mm-hmm.
Totally different than anything I'd ever had when I was in America.
Well, the story from my father is the history is that prohibition, you actually had at least one brewery in every community because that's where your beer came from. And that because of prohibition, you basically lost that and you got the conglomerate type of approach that took over. And now you're really seeing going what I call back to the future and getting back to the basics. And it is really is interesting to see how people, you think of a place such as Bend, Oregon.
That's
and
true.
And they, I think they have in the city now, I'm going to say 12, if not 13 different breweries. And you wonder, how can they be doing this? But what they are doing in many cases are finding that niche, something new, something different.
Mm-hmm.
In the Corvallis area, I know that there's the one that's just opened up off 34 that's focusing on Belgium styles. And so you're just finding, you know, that, and people are rediscovering what was a lost art.
In fact, the niche of our brewery is that we are specializing in cask ales, and the interesting thing about a cask ale is in most beer, the beer is chilled when it's finished fermenting, and the yeast actually drops out of suspension. All the CO2 is bled off. That's CO2 and alcohol is a byproduct of the yeast metabolism as it consumes the sugars. That beer is then put in another tank and artificially carbonated, and that's the beer that one normally gets out of the tap on the wall. What we do is, as the beer is finished fermenting, we seal it in a cask. It continues to ferment, produce its own CO2 in there, and the yeast stays in that cask and alive and adds to the flavor and the complexity of the beer. Those beers are not forced out by a CO2. They're drawn out by a hand pump that literally pumps the beer out into the glass. It's less carbonated. It's a little warmer. This is why Americans joke that the English like warm, flat beer, because it's really not warm. It's just not as cold, and it's not flat. It's just not as carbonated. But it's a niche for us. There's not many people doing that in Oregon. There's one other pub that I know of near Eugene in Oak Ridge. And and again, for us, that's special because the yeast is still in the beer. And
the one in Oak Ridge just happens to be in Senate District 4.
Oh,
not coincidence. district.
Okay, so any further questions? I see none. Thank you very much.
Thank
is there
you.
Anyone else
Appreciate
that would like to testify? I'm not seeing anyone else out there that wants to testify, so we're going to close the public hearing on HCR 12, and we'll open a work session on HCR 12.
Mr. Chair, I move for the House concurrent resolution HCR 12 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Pozanski moves HCR 12 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none. Is there any opposition? Seeing none. So moved. Senator Pozanski, would you care to carry this bill?
I'd be honored to.
And for the record, Senator Bertschinger is excused. So we're going to close our work session on HCR 12, and we're going to open a work session on House Bill 3067 for the purpose of asking for unanimous consent to allow Senator Close to, you can make the motion.
However you want it. Mr. Chair, I move that the rules be suspended to allow Senator Close to vote on House Bill 3067.
Senator Pozanski moves that the rules be suspended to allow Senator Close to vote for HB 3067. Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. Senator Close, how do you vote on Senate Bill 36, House Bill 3067?
I vote aye.
Senator Close votes aye on House Bill 3067. So we're going to close our work session on House Bill 3067. I think that does all the stuff that we have for today. I thank you for your attention and work, and we will adjourn our meeting of the Senate Committee on Rural Communities and Economic Development. Thank you very much.